ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Bruce Tuckman, a media investor, advisor, and entrepreneur who has played a central role in transforming some of the most popular U.S. media brands into truly global enterprises. He's now utilizing his experience to explore the new distribution and business models that will set the pace for the industry in the future. He's a board member of the global data science company Parrot Analytics and a senior advisor to iFlix and AMC Networks. He recently served as president of AMC Global and Sundance Channel Global, where he led the distribution, programming, business development, and marketing of both brands internationally. He's also a member of the executive committee of the board of directors of the International Academy of Television Arts and Sciences and a winner of the National Medal of Arts awarded by President Obama. So first of all, thank you so much for being on the program. I want to dive in. There's so much we can cover. So data has played an important part in the rise of Netflix and Amazon, but a common criticism is that big data is anti-creative and it only creates permutations of things that already exist. And what I'm interested in is your thoughts around the intersection between a leader's singular vision and data and how they should play off one another.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I'd say, though, in fact, it's probably an exaggeration of what Netflix and Amazon are doing right now. It could be used that way, data. It could be used that way in creative executives and producers and content providers could just wait for the data readout to tell them exactly how to construct a story and what to say. But you know what? That ultimately fails because story making is essentially a human activity that's not necessarily a linear or logical activity. It's a creative activity. That's obvious. For Amazon and Netflix, what I imagine they're doing, but what I would also suggest the best leaders do, you use the data to help you gain some insights into how people may react to your story or what people are looking for, what works or what's failed in the past. That's always helpful. And there's nothing novel about that. It's just that there's actually a lot more information now than there ever was. People who create shows and movies, as you know, for years, they do focus groups, they poll and ask individuals what they think. So this is probably just a more comprehensive and far more rich vein of feedback to tap into. But surely, when I look at, I'm just thinking a couple of things like from Amazon, Man in High Castle. I don't think any data pointed them to that story. It's just a great story. And in fact, the story was created long before we had an internet. It was a Philip K. Dick book. So I don't think it's predictive in that sense. And then I look at probably the biggest hit on Netflix. We don't get data from Netflix to tell us what the biggest hit this summer was, but I think it was Stranger Things. Right. I doubt there's any algorithm or output from data that said, okay, create a story based in the 80s. A sci-fi story with Winona Ryder. I don't think any of that would come up. I don't think that's any slight
evolution. You don't think there was a nostalgia thing, maybe, that these things were popular, we want something like these films, that wasn't informing this selection?
It could be, but I don't think the data leads to that. Uh-huh. I think it's still the other way around. They were just pitched this idea. Actually, if you read about the producers, they're just young guys who have created this story in their head. It's a great story.
It's fantastic.
I still think the successful programmers are out there going with their gut, with their professional expertise and data. The use of it can only help them in terms of making better decisions, but shouldn't substitute for the creative instinct.
Right. So really, our success will still depend on the singular vision of the people sort of leading the charge.
Yes, and I also believe in terms of real creative fiction, narrative stuff, that those who rely solely on data will utterly fail.
As a creative person, I hope you're right. One of the other things is recently you wrote an article about the ascendance of niche services and how they might eclipse generalist things that, you know, and simultaneously we're seeing press around skinny bundles, and people like John Martin at Turner are saying there are too many channels and we should expect sort of a ruthless winnowing because there simply is too much. And even that the cable channel explosion that happened, people still only looked at, you know, 14 channels, that there was sort of, you know, 80% of people's time is spent on 20% of what's going on, what's available. So how do we balance those two things?
Well, let's start with the cord shaving or skinny bundles. There seems to be the evolution of this argument. Maybe a year or more ago, everyone said the world's going to skinny bundles. Then there seemed to have been a pushback from the channel industry. No, it's not like that, because, you know, it's still kind of incomplete. The technology gets a little funky. Sometimes the broadcast networks aren't there. I think the discussion and the categorization, skinny bundle, cord shaving, whatever, that we get too wrapped up in it. We should look at the macroeconomics of it. Clearly, subscriptions to pay TV are going down. We are understanding the reasons for that, because there's alternatives, the rise of alternative media. Young people just don't seem to be as interested when there is a new household formation to make the first thing they get cable. So there's pressure on the industry. Now, what do you do when demand, in essence, because that's what's happening, for your product goes down? The classical answer, really the only answer, is, well, you got to lower your prices. I mean, the cable operators have been trying to give you more stuff so they don't have to lower the prices, like broadband internet and mobile. But consumers, especially young consumers, they don't want a triple play anymore, right? They adult households too. They're, you know, I don't want a landline. Why are you forcing me to take a landline? I don't need the quadruple play. So there's a lot of that going on. So inevitably, the cable operators are going to have to price lower. Right. And when they price lower, it's going to be a bloodbath, because there are all these channels out there that have only been used to for over a generation. Renewals come up, they get a little more money, they're happy, they grow. If you're lowering your prices, you're not going to cut into your margins just to satisfy 100 marginal channels. Right. So it's inevitable. And so what I'm saying is inevitable is the skinny bundles are going to happen, however you call it. And it may not be the sling skinny bundle with 20 channels, but I think you're going to see a world where you have the opportunity to buy much less channels and you're offered much smaller bouquets at a better price. I think that comes no matter what. Now, in terms of niche SVOD, that's one of the reasons, of course, why there's pressure on cable, just SVOD generally. Every single day that goes by, look back 5 years ago, 6 years ago, Netflix was still a relatively wonky kind of thing to do. You know, there were bells and whistles and you had to wait. And I remember on my TV, when I watched the first season of House of Cards, you know, it would like stall and you'd have to wait. And on your computer sometimes. Now it all works pretty seamlessly.
Right.
But with each day that goes by, all of these OTT apps are going to be integrated so well. I mean, there's so many people looking at it, thinking about this, working on new apps to just integrate everything. I think it's inevitable at some point. I don't know if it's a few years from now, whatever, that it's probably going to be very difficult for consumer to really distinguish between what's a channel, what's an app. I don't care. It's all delivered by IP. I just click on something I like, or I push a button and I watch. I'm watching Netflix. I didn't realize, or I'm watching HBO. I didn't realize I'm watching the OTT HBO or the other one. I think that's what's going to happen. And I think as a result, there will be more and more demand for niche OTT product, because every single form of media that has come before this, I can't name one, When it's invented, it disrupts a previous incarnation of media that then gets hurt, but reconsolidates, figures out its way, but inevitably goes from generalist offerings to more and more specialized offerings. Name a form of media, magazines, for instance. You know, we started with the Gutenberg Bible. All right, now, you know.
That's a pretty big.
And us goes to Ibiza or something like that.
But then you have, you have, I think, a discoverability issue. And then also to speak to your economics, right? I mean, how do these very skinny bundles, or not bundles, these very niche channels, how do they get enough revenue to create content and enough depth of content? Because people are voracious. They chew through it pretty quickly. Content's really expensive. How is that possible? I mean, what's the limit? I can understand consumers wanting it, but then there's the cost intersection. Where's that intersection?
Yeah, you know, I shouldn't be this focused on the magazine business, but since I brought it up, look, okay, the magazine business had, you know, but for digital coming to disrupt it, the magazine business was that way for 60, 70 years. Discovery, you know, there's so many titles, it's hard to publicize all of them. They catered to real niche things. You had to hire staffs and all that print expense. And bad magazines, much like bad specialized OTT services, will fail. Mm-hmm. So it's just got to be good. And you'll get it out there. Now, unlike the magazine business, which, you know, is now being usurped by many ways or surpassed by the digital business, there's nothing right now surpassing the digital business. Consumers really will gravitate to specialized SVOD services because, as I mentioned, it'll be easier to access on all your screens, especially for more mature audiences on their big screen at home.
Right.
If they're good, they will get discovered because the power of the search engines and the power of programmatic marketing, you will get known if you have something good to offer. But you got to have something good to offer. And I think for niche SVOD, you also have to have a lower purchase price. There's this argument out there that, well, consumers aren't going to wind up paying more money than they paid for cable, so they're not going to buy all of these little SVOD apps. But I argue they will because that price point is not so meaningful when you get down to that level. It will be for some consumers. Let's go back to the magazine business. I don't know anyone ever who was saying, I will only spend $100 a month or $50 a month on magazines. You got a magazine because you were interested in it. It was reasonably priced. And that's what's going to happen with niche OTT.
But the one thing that with magazines and similar to old-fashioned television is you released your magazine at regular intervals and you didn't have demanding consumers who were like, but I want another issue right now. And why should I pay to subscribe if I don't get as many issues as I want right away? You know, so in old traditional television, you know, you had your fall season and, you know, whereas if you are seeing things and you're binging, there is no season. How many new shows should launch when you're dealing with an on-demand product?
Well, an on-demand product certainly forces you to refresh quicker than the linear business. But it is more akin to the magazine business because, you know, 1 month you have your on-demand offering, you go through as much, and then the next month it's refreshed. And similarly, the next month you get a new issue of Vanity Fair or whatever. I want to get away from trying to just make it fit into the magazine industry because it's really not that. And it's really actually, I think, far more valuable and going to make a much bigger impression and have a lot more reach ultimately than that.
Do you see it as being primarily or entirely subscription-based, or do you see that there would be an advertising component?
There's both, and there's a lot of that. And obviously, YouTube set up the whole free model.
Right.
The free model has been one of the most radical cultural disruptive phenomena, obviously, that we've all seen, because now everyone can see this amazing content and it's changed society. It's changed criminal justice because it was for free. If you're just a business person who likes the subscription model, back in the early 90s, you were warning people, don't give it away for free. You'll never get money for it again. And I think that kind of content will never get money. But the people behind premium content, movies, high quality series, never got into that habit of offering it for free, really.
Right.
So the consumer doesn't have an expectation or shouldn't have an expectation that they'll get it for free. And it seems to be a sustainable enough business that people will pay, whether it's through their cable TV or OTT, for good content, and they'll pay good money.
Right. So then it almost is like we're going to have two levels of content. You're going to have subscription based, you know, high end quality content, and then somewhat more advertiser supported, less high quality seems like a bad way to put it, but maybe it's just not scripted. Maybe it's reality or it's live. And if we're talking about anything where you've got advertising involved, you know, we think about, you know, ratings as currency. And I'm curious about, you know, is really volume of views how we should be measuring things, or should we be thinking about engagement and valuing and measuring it differently?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, there will be nothing new going on here in terms of there being ad-based models,
right?
Subscription-based models, and then freebie user-generated stuff. That's how every form of media has always worked. And, you know, you conform to the opportunities and limitations of that kind of economic return for each one of those. In terms of measurement, yeah, look, that's still evolving, especially digital engagement. And there's a lot, there's as many people blown away and saying this is the second coming, and it is. But there are people also who are trying to figure out, you know, if an ad pops up for 3 seconds, is that engagement? Is just the mere fact, or is there something deeper? I don't know the answer yet, but the pace of evolution of the internet is extraordinary, and it's real time, unlike all these other older technologies. So more and more people are learning. And so I guess to answer the question, I think things will develop so that true passion is ascertainable.
Right. Is there, I mean, if you were to say what kinds of intelligence are necessary to help move things forward, what kind of measurements would you like to see, you know, in the next five, like, what do you think, gee whiz, we really need this within the next 5 years and in order to move things along?
Well, I think it's astonishing that, and there's something really, really ludicrous about the fact that, I don't know, it's $60 billion, is it maybe a year, of ad revenue is transacted on the basis of the Nielsen panels. The Nielsen panels are, I think, 30,000, maybe it's 50,000 homes meant to represent 310 or so million Americans. And up until just, I think, the last couple of months, for some of the homes, they were still using paper diaries.
So that's a little alarming.
We know intrinsically now, even when there wasn't an internet, we knew how kind of fragile or you have to take a mental leap on that. But I think Nielsen's taking a lot of criticism in and of itself, but I would also argue this election shows you that relying on surveys of people don't mean nothing. You can get it really wrong.
Right.
So Nielsen's inherently flawed, but now it's in bright relief. It's shining in because of all the digital alternatives. So something like Parrot Analytics, I sit on their board, is not hypothesizing or extrapolating from 50,000 American homes and saying, yeah, now 100 people watched the debate and 15 million people watched Super Bowl or whatever it is. It is none of that hocus pocus. There is just measurement of actual people doing actual things. And the internet now is so vast, and there's billions of points of data that you can tap into and analyze and sift through every day to get a real picture of what people are doing, liking, who these people are, what their demographics are. You can create cross sections by saying, do these people like automobiles? What automobiles they like? It. And so that's so much richer. And the fact that it's just tapped into, you know, this is like the shift from Cro-Magnon men to Homo sapiens, all right? They're going to fade out and something else is going to happen. Right. And that's what's going on right now.
Right, right. Well, also interesting, that's sort of a nice segue. So we're dealing now really with moving to global content. I mean, certainly on Netflix, I consume a lot of stuff that's BBC, you know, that I didn't used to have access to. And so looking at what's popular globally and also spreading, you know, channels, spreading globally. And I know that with your background, obviously, you have huge insight into that. And I'm interested in terms of how you think media and entertainment companies should be pushing globally. Do they need to adapt for these cultures that they're going into, or do they have one strategy to push out? What do you think is, what are your views on how entertainment content companies should go global?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think at the moment, the two really powerful emerging drivers towards globalization are one, especially for the movie business, the Chinese movie market, right? That'll be bigger soon. I think they're saying any day, month than the US.
Right.
So how can you be a producer of anything, cars, consumer products, movies, if you just write off half of your audience or more? So the global audience is so much more important than ever for films that it is creating globalized product. People complain, no, it's all superhero stuff. It's really US stuff. No, it's really global stuff. That's what people really want. And I would argue not as many people in the US may want that. So I think they're doing a good job with that. That's a force. And that's also happening with expensive TV series.
Right.
You cannot amortize a big expensive show like a Westworld or something without having international exposure, international sales, and also marketing and popularity. There's no way you can cover your costs. The other driver comes the other way. Apparently, these statistics are out there. I can't verify them. There's going to be 500 original dramas created in the U.S. this year, which is several fold higher than 2007 or so when Mad Men came out. And already there was a lot of quality stuff coming out. Folks are running out of ideas. There's too much stuff. Now, and especially now if you're thinking more globally and you're running out of ideas, and maybe there's a lot of, if you're confining yourself to just listening to ideas that take place in the U.S. about the U.S., only about U.S. characters, well, that's becomes a little limiting too. Mm. So I think you're seeing in a lot of these media companies, clearly people are looking internationally for ideas.
Okay.
That explains the phenomena in Scandinavia and all the shows in the U.S. that have been formats bought from Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Israel, more than anyone, they are just killing with their formats, producing left and right. And I'd say we have a lot more to learn just by being in this business. You know, I try to watch cinema in a lot of different countries, and I just see, especially for the action genre, so much more creativity in terms of storylines and stuff, so much more freshness coming out of big markets like Brazil, Indonesia, and India than I do in the U.S. And inevitably that will wind up competing or informing new ideas.
Right, right, right. That makes sense. Do you think that that piracy data itself as a proxy for demand is useful? Should networks be looking at that stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, people look at car crashes and they learn from them, right? Not to do like something stupid and get in a car crash. There's so much to learn from the piracy data. Now, we also know from the piracy data that the pirates tend to be younger males. You're not enabling it by looking at the data.
Right.
You're enabling it by doing...
by ignoring it.
Yeah. So I think everyone should look at that and get better ideas what people want around the world. I think it only benefit to create better programming.
Right. Well, we've hit our half hour. I still have a couple of questions. This is just sort of more general things that I usually toss out at all of my guests. So I'm going to toss some words to you, and just top of mind, whatever first comes to mind, just respond. Okay, you ready?
Okay, yeah.
Facebook.
Friends.
Google.
Search.
Snap.
I'm not being imaginative.
No, what? That's okay. It's whatever first comes to mind. You can't take too long, or else I'll know you're thinking too hard on it.
Okay.
Snapchat.
Kids.
Twitter.
Crowded.
YouTube.
Music.
Ah, that's interesting. Ad blockers.
Don't use them.
Art.
Science.
VR.
We'll see.
AR.
We'll really see.
AI.
Yes, that's here already. No one knows it, but it's bigger and bigger by the day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What excites you about the current media landscape?
What excites me is it's now just being reinvented, you know, as we speak. It's radically changing. It scares and excites me. It excites me because it offers me personally opportunity. But the scary part is there's a lot of money going now. You know, we talked about all these linear channels before.
Right.
There's so much money going towards things people aren't watching. And then the things people are excited about watching aren't being paid attention enough to.
Right.
That's not sustainable, right? That the money will eventually shift. It will break. I think what is slowing that down are these like AT&T Time Warner mergers and things like that. They're going to just create so much heft,
right,
that for them to move or be moved, more importantly, or be disrupted is hard because they're so big, and it takes, you know, it took millions of years to create the Grand Canyon, eroding it slowly and slowly. And that's what I think conventional media bigness is going to do. It shouldn't be in that form anymore. And that's what's exciting. But it's scary because eventually it collapses and it's going to be messy.
Well, sure. And also you have a lot of powerful stakeholders who have very vested interests in not changing things. So, I mean, you're sort of out of it and playing with the opportunities, but there are people who are still in it and have a lot of reasons not to shift those dollars, I would think.
That's correct. And that's why I think it's a challenge for the conventional media companies. You don't see many of them really succeeding in this new OTT world in a major way. I mean, there could be exceptions. I can't think of any offhand, but
well,
you look at
telling,
it.
Telling, isn't it? You can't think. I mean, you should, if there is an exception, it should pop into your mind. You know, you should be like, oh, except, boom. But you
no,
don't have.
I mean, except WWE, who I compliment on their, they were ahead of everyone on this. They were taking so much criticism several years ago. HBO to a limited extent with their OTT product, but it's still not big numbers like Netflix. And they still have an essential conflict with their linear business they have to deal with. I think your biggest problem in the linear business shifting is at a senior management level. These tend to be people who were creating a whole new media when cable was young or just being born.
Right.
Now they have to put it to rest and start something new. That's hard to do,
right,
at the end of a career. And then you have huge, huge staffs, and you can't ask them to spend your whole day figuring out how to disrupt this place so that we can have 50% less employees, do it more cheaply, and be OTT. And that's not going to happen.
No.
Bureaucracies push back, and people just kind of walk it back, slow-mo it. It's kind of like what's going on with Brexit. You know, someone said do it, and then everyone's figuring out a way not to.
Right. Except it's a bit different, I guess, just because what you've got is it's going to happen anyway. If the biggies don't change, what's going to happen is the disruption will happen. Somebody else will do it. And those jobs that they're protecting, will more people will suffer because they won't be where they need to be. You know, future planning, they won't hit the curve where they need to hit it.
I think a lot of people get that, of course. But if you're working in one of these companies, it's kind of abstract. It's kind of like, yes, inevitably it will happen, but then I'll just get a new job. Meanwhile, I'll stay here and make my money.
Right. True. Very true. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's really, really fantastic. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Gabriella.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people. First, the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Thank you. Our production team over at Microfame Media. Big thank you to our guest and new friend, Bruce Tuckman. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.